Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
This is the Detours Travel Show here on Joy 94.9. I'm Jodie, joined by Greg, and it's about 7 minutes past 12 today. Coming up shortly on the program, we'll be speaking with Brian Thacker, who is here in the studio going to talk about his new book, which is hot off the press, called Tell Them to Get Lost. I'd like to tell a couple of people to get lost, but I'm too polite. What about you, Greg?
I'm also too polite as well. But I'll tell you, for book launches, as book launches go, Brian's launch down at Readings in St Kilda was one of the most interesting book launches I've been to. And a range of people all hearing the tales. We might kick off and I'll ask Brian Thacker, with your book launch, we often hear people reading parts of their books. Well, it certainly wasn't a reading at Readings, was it? Tell me about that.
Oh, well, good afternoon, Jodie and Greg, and thanks for having me again.
Our pleasure.
Yes, well, because the book is about travelling with the original Southeast Asia on a Shoestring Lonely Planet guidebook from 1974, I thought I'd do a bit of a 1974 theme. Hence, I look like a pimp with my nice purple felt hat and my very flared pants. But also, very 1970s, I had a slideshow. So I just showed some photos and kicked off with what life was like in 1974 and what music they listened to and movies and then comparison shots of course, Tony and Maureen Wheeler started Lonely Planet and some photos of them when they were travelling around in 1974 compared to today.
So think back, and think, if you're listening, think back about what you were doing in 1974. Now, a lot of you wouldn't have been born in 1974 because it's we're talking a long time ago. We're talking close to 40 years ago, 37 years ago.
We'd love to hear from you. If you've got a if you've got a question for Brian as you're listening about his books and in particular the new one, Tell Them to Get Lost, you can SMS us on 0427JOY949 or email us on air at joy.org.au. So, Brian, what inspired you to actually write this book?
I was sitting with Tony Wheeler at a writer's festival after the writer's festival, just at a table doing signing and no one was coming to buy our books. And I was telling him how many years ago I travelled with an old guidebook about Corfu that I picked up for 10 cents at a boot sale in London. And it was 16 years after the guidebook was written. And so I hired a motorbike and it said, there's this beautiful little beach with a tiny little place to have some lunch and ride a bike around the corner. And there's 100 hotels and full of Brits in their Union Jack boxer shorts reading the Sun newspaper, eating bangers and mash. It was like the place had changed dramatically. So I was just telling Tony about how things can change. And then I said, an idea, I said, has anyone ever tried to travel with the first guidebook or anyone try to do that? Any of the old guidebooks, Lonely Planet ones? And he said, I can't recall anyone do it. I had an idea just then. I went, do you reckon you better give me one of your first guidebook? And he goes, yeah. And within minutes, I was planning the trip through Southeast Asia, East Timor, Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, Burma, Laos, and Singapore, and following the same route as Tony and Maureen Wheeler did in 1974 to write the book. And of course,
brilliant, just brilliant.
The big thing is that I then travelled only using the 1974 guidebook. So I had no idea what was going to be there or what wasn't.
So when you say that, does that mean where they took a boat to go from point to point, you actually replicated that and found a boat
yes,
service?
As much as I could. And they did most of it on a motorbike that they're travelling. So I tried to get on motorbikes as much as I could as well along the way. But and of course, some countries didn't even make it into the guidebook because Vietnam was at the tail end of the war and Philippines was under martial law and Cambodia, Pol Pot was running amok. So those countries wouldn't even make the guidebook. But Portuguese Timor became an Indonesian colony and then independence in 2002, so some places had changed dramatically.
It's hard to imagine a world before guidebooks or the prevalence of people's stories and travelling through particular areas, because, you know, so many of us rely on them for advice and information. Do you think people rely too much on guidebooks?
Yes, one of the biggest things I saw was when, it wasn't for this book, it was a little while ago, I was in Vietnam and I'd met some backpackers on a boat. It was funny because the boat was recommended in Lonely Planet, and I remember walking to the boat and every single person had a Lonely Planet in their hand. I mean, it was a great boat tour, that's why they did it, but they met these people and it's great, you meet other backpackers and you go out for dinner. And I said to someone, we're looking for somewhere to eat. And I said, what about this place? This looks good. And one of the girls says, oh, no, it's not in Lonely Planet. So you wouldn't even eat there because it wasn't in Lonely Planet.
I know when I went to India recently and I had the Lonely Planet guidebook for India, and oh, my God, it's like a brick. It was so huge. And at that stage, I wasn't sure if I was going to the north or the south, and I ended up going to both. But, you know, it was actually quite heavy to lug around. The Southeast Asia on a Shoestring, the first book by Tony and Maureen Wheeler, was actually written by them in a hotel room at the end of the journey, wasn't it?
Yeah, they put the whole thing together in room two of the Palace Hotel in Singapore. And they spent a few months there. But the current Southeast Asia on a Shoestring is a bit over 1,000 pages. The old one's only 148 pages.
Now, Maureen and Tony would have taken copious paper notes as they travelled around.
Yeah.
What did you do? Or you didn't replicate that method of note-taking?
Yeah, I still do that anyway. I do take notes.
Did you really?
Yeah, I still do anyway. So, and even, I know, I wanted to do it because I did find room two of the Palace Hotel. It's now changed and they'd cut the rooms in half and it's room minus half, one and a two or something.
Yeah.
I don't know what room it is now. But I sat at the same sort of desk and with my notes and was writing notes on my last day, and I just liked that idea that I was doing finishing off the same way that they finished off theirs.
Well, we'll hear more about that in just a few minutes. This is the Detours Travel Show here on Joy. We're joined by Brian Thacker, hearing about his new book called Tell Them to Get Lost. And, well, we don't want you to get lost. We want you to stay with us till 1 o'clock here on Joy.
Joy 94.9. Reaching far and wide. Stream us now. joy.org.au.
And that great track there before was Blame It on the Boogie by the Jacksons here on Joy 94.9. I'm Jody, joined by Greg. This is Detours, and we have in the studio with us Brian Thacker. Now, Brian has just launched his latest book, and it is called Tell Them to Get Lost, and it's retracing the steps of Tony and Maureen Wheeler's first book, Southeast Asia on a Shoestring, 1974. That track was 1978, but never mind. That was my choice. So how did you go about planning this major trip, and how long were you away for?
Well, the planning is not much planning at all. I just went with the old guidebook. Tony did point out that there was a couple of hotels still around, but I was a tiny bit worried that everything would just be a highway overpass, but it didn't turn out that way at all. It turned out much better than I ever imagined, because there was lots of places around. But the first place I flew into was East Timor without having any idea if places were still there. I showed the guy how much is a taxi? I showed the guy the old guidebook and said, it's a dollar. It says in the guidebook, it's a dollar. And he says, like, no, it's not a dollar, you know. And the first place I went to, the beach hotel, which is dubbed the Hippie Hilton, where you paid a dollar and you could stay as long as you want, and you sleep on a concrete floor on the beach in this shack sort of thing. And so he took me to where he said, oh, yes, I'll take you there. And, of course, he dropped me off and it's just a concrete slab. It's not there anymore. So I was a little bit worried, but there was really no planning at all, except to find out about visas to get to places like Burma, etc. And the rest I just had no idea, and just walking around with my old guidebook with very bad maps trying to find restaurants and hotels.
Now, when you say very bad, what do you mean by that?
Well, for the one in Dili, for example, didn't have any street names at all. So it's just crossed lines of the streets. They don't have places marked on the map, but many of those places, whether it's an airline office or a certain type of bank or a restaurant, they're not there anymore, or they've moved or done something, so you have no point of reference of where you are. But some of the maps are okay. At least they had names in it.
Yeah, that's helpful.
And in the actual map of Timor, it had the roads, and it didn't say what their names or what they were. It just had a line and a line for a guide, and it says that bad roads, and had a dotted line, worse roads. And that was all the reference there was.
One of the first things I do when I turn up somewhere is get a map of the local area, because I feel that grounds me and orientates me. But we were speaking recently to a guest who acknowledged that he suffers terribly from geographic dyslexia, and even in Melbourne, when he's familiar with the environment, can't find his way around. What about your internal compass? Have you got a good sense of direction, Brian?
No, not really, but I actually quite enjoy that for travelling, because I like getting lost and, oh, that's finding a street that you didn't know existed before. But there was lots of getting lost in this, wandering around with these maps, but it was fun.
Yeah, I bet.
Now, you're a seasoned traveller, so getting lost is enjoyable. It's part of the journey, the experience, part of the detour. Remember back to when you first got lost travelling. What was that experience like?
It was probably when I first got off the plane, the first time I went overseas, when I was trying to find my hotel, and I thought, trying to look at the map and figure, no, that's far away, I'll get a taxi. And I got in a taxi, and he drove me across the bridge. This is in Frankfurt in Germany. First time out of Australia. Drove me across the bridge, down the road, down this back street. Oh, I've seen Frankfurt, then across another bridge under the river again, dropped me off at the hotel, checked into my room, walked downstairs, walked two buildings up, and there across the road was the train station. So he'd take me for a bit of a ride. So.
Yeah. But there are some good cab drivers in the world. The ones that I've met who, you know, they're just really kind and help you get to where you need to go. But there's some who will rip you off.
No, I don't think he was ripping me off. I think it was all one-way systems, and you had to go around to get back to it.
Yeah.
Well, I came out of a Chinese railway station straight into the arms of a cab driver. One looked more friendly. He was actually quite cute. And straight into his arms, and he guided me to the hotel. Not the one I was going to, but one he recommended was much better, and introduced me along the way to this woman that was a bit of a travel courier. So she then organised, gave me a card with a number, and she then organised hotels for the next couple of legs, and we got better hotels far cheaper than the rates you could pay here from Australia.
Wow.
So some of those networks you meet through the cab drivers can be quite fortuitous.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's very true. Now, Brian, so you didn't plan a lot for this trip, and how long were you away for?
12 weeks all up. Sort of in the old guide book, you could tell places that they liked, because more than a third of the book is on Indonesia alone. So and big chapter on Bali, so they really liked Bali. And because they spent such a long time in Singapore, there was a big, huge restaurant section in there, when some other cities, they only have one restaurant listed. So I sort of followed how much I spent more time in Indonesia. And back in 1974, you only could get a 7-day visa for Burma. Now you can get 28 days. So I got a 28-day visa, that's what you get. But I only did 7 days. I did it in 7 days to try to follow there. It was like rushing around.
The authenticity of the book.
Following the book.
Very good.
And did you feel that they got it right? I mean, maybe the time is different, but did they spend enough time pulling it together? Would you, if you were in their shoes, would you have done anything differently?
Well, they probably, I think of someone just doing guidebooks a few years ago. Now there's maybe 10 writers, you know, on it, but even then they only spend a certain amount of time. And the Wheeler spent 12 months travelling doing that, so they, you know, really put time and effort into it.
So what were some of the places that really surprised you along the way on this trip?
I think most surprising was the people, that the people were still in. For example, in Ubud in Bali, in the old guidebook says there's this little lady performing miracles in a tiny kitchen, Chandra's restaurant in Monkey Forest Road in Ubud. And first of all, I got excited so often when a restaurant or a hotel was still there. I got very excited. So I went in there, and I was asked the question, is Chandra's still around? And, oh, yes, she's in the kitchen.
Oh, my goodness.
So 35 years later, she's still cooking in a tiny kitchen.
And that's incredible. That's the connector, isn't it? So you're connected to Tony and Maureen and their experiences in that moment.
Mm.
Did you share some of that connection with them? Did you ever ring them while you were travelling around?
Even better. because Tony joined me for part of the trip. And I had planned to meet him the next day in Ubud. That was the plan. And I was sitting in Chandri's after I just met Chandri, and she came and spoke to me for ages and said it had her son. And then Tony Wheeler walks past.
No way.
And so I ran out to him. I know Tony, I ran out with the old guidebook in my hand and said, "Excuse me, can you help me? I'm just trying to find it. Map's not very good." And he just laughed. And then he came and joined me for a beer with Chandri, and Tony was saying, you know, how fantastic Chandri's was. There's probably 150 restaurants in Ubud now. Back then there was only three. And he said this place was full every night. You couldn't get a table. It was just oil lamps, and there was a dirt road and just ducks. And he said everyone used to come for her tacos, and they're not Mexican, they're Indonesian sort of tacos, but that's still on the menu. And I was so excited as well. Like, I said to Chandri, this is Tony Wheeler, this is Mr. Lonely Planet, you know, like, it was very exciting.
And did you have anyone else travel with you along the way?
Well, yes, I met someone in Ubud, actually. I met a girl, and on Tony Wheeler was in Ubud for a writers' festival, and he was doing a walk through the rice paddies, talking about just what Bali was like and when he first came here. And so I was on that walk, and there was an American girl on the walk, and we started chatting, and we went out for that night for a drink, and then we went out the next night and the next night, and then said, "Why don't you come travel with me?" So she'd then join me in Malaysia and Thailand, and then we had a long-distance relationship with America, and then 18 months ago she moved here.
No way.
Yes.
See, when I asked that question, I didn't know. So you're talking about Beth.
Yeah.
My goodness. Well, so you actually met when you were travelling on this recent trip?
Yeah, for this book.
How gorgeous. I love it.
Which probably explains Brian Thacker, author of Tell Them to Get Lost, recently launched, in fact, during the week, where Jodie and I both went, explains why she was there at the launch.
Yes.
In the middle of the... And I've got to share with you, because in the middle of the slideshow that Brian put on, of course he had to put up a picture of his partner, and she was mortified. Yes. The look on her face was just fantastic.
Because she said, "You're not putting one up, are you?" And I said, "Oh, yeah." I
do love the old slideshows, though. I mean, you know, my dad's a photographer, and you know, one of my favourite memories of after the holidays were actually looking at the slideshows with a big bowl of popcorn and with the projector, and it always getting too hot, you let it cool it down a little bit it wouldn't melt, and then you'd go back to it again. I mean, do we do that anymore? Do we actually share our photos, or do we just whack them up on social media and go, you know, flick through them if you want?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, I think we might share them. We might actually whack them up on the LCD in the lounge room and run through them while people try to crawl out the first available moment.
Yes.
See, what I love though, Brian, about your slideshow was that it was really interesting because your commentary told stories along the way, but you know, you don't want to be just seeing, you know, people in their bathers in front of Eiffel Tower or whatever all the time. I mean, not bathers, but I was thinking beach and got all mixed up then, but... if you've just joined the show, this is Detours here on Joy 94.9. It's nearly 12:30. I'm Jodie, joined by Greg, and we have Brian Thacker joining us here in the studio.
And not only do we have Brian Thacker, we have some of Brian Thacker's music. So you've chosen a particular number to centre us around 1974. Brian, give us a bit of an intro.
Yes, well, at 74, the charts, first for the number one hit in Australia was My Cuckoo Choo by Elvin Stardust, which I don't have because that's terrible. But another big hit was a song by Carl Douglas called... Everybody Was Kung Fu Fighting.
Oh, let's have a listen.
And if you'd like to SMS us 0427JOY949, you might have a question for Brian. I know we've had a couple of SMSs that we'll come to in a minute. You can email us on onair@joy.org.au.
Oh, beautiful. Joy 94.9.
Everybody was kung fu fighting. Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah. Melbourne's most lovable station is now giving you more reasons to listen.
Saturday nights on Joy 94.9. From 7, A Touch of Pink. At 9, Full Catastrophe. From 11, Finalism. And from 3 a.m, Trance Around the World.
For the full program guide and to download the free Joy app, see joy.org.au.
The perfect mix of music, news and interviews. Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
You are on Joy 94.9. This is Detours with Jodie and Greg, and our special guest today, returning for his, I think it's his third visit, it's Brian Thacker. Author of Tell Them to Get Lost.
I think it might be like more.
I think so.
It might be the fourth or fifth visit.
Yeah.
Like you're a regular.
Yes.
Exactly. Now, your latest book that you just recently launched last week, Tell Them to Get Lost, retracing the steps of the first book by Maureen and Tony Wheeler, 1974, travel book, Southeast Asia on a Shoestring. So we talked about some of the things that were surprising, the people who were still there after more than 30 years. What were some of the things that about the accommodation that you came across from the guidebook?
Oh, that was a good thing too. It was very different. They weren't just all not there, but also not just all run down. Some places hadn't been in a guidebook for 25 years, and you can see why, because they had the same sheets from 1974.
Oh, gross.
And the same 1974 fans spinning at you, and stains all over the wall, and so some of them, like, very scary, some of the places, which makes for a great book, you know, for writing a book.
But you had to sleep there. You stayed there.
Yeah, well, one place, and it was with Beth at that point, and her face was just amazing. It was so funny. We walked into one place because her jaw was, like, dropped. But she wouldn't put it back up again. She was just looking around the room. And I was all excited because I'd stayed in worse places than that so far. And again, it's got air conditioning and it's got hot water. And we just laid all our clothes on the sheet, so you didn't have to actually touch the sheets.
Touch anything, yeah, wise move.
And then it was too scary. But I stayed in one place in Burma, which was the worst, where it was so disgusting. I nicknamed it the Hotel Grime. I arrived at 3 o'clock in the morning from a night train without knowing where I was staying, because I didn't do any research, of course, and found this hotel and knocked on the door for ages, and they let me in, and the room was just so dirty. It was just piled thick with dust everywhere.
Gross.
And I said, can I change rooms? And he said, no, there's no other room. I said, well, I want to pay cheaper. You know, I'm not going to pay for this. And he said, no, I clean it. So he woke up two teenage boys at 3 o'clock in the morning. They came up and they got a bucket of water and they just threw that around the bathroom. And then a feather duster.
To move the dust around.
Which was now thick, you know, like it's grown, the dust had settled. And then they sprayed a bit of air freshener and then they left.
Beauty.
But the opposite side was, Beth and I had stayed in this really dodgy hotel. It was in Malacca in Malaysia. It was called the New Cathay Hotel. We just stayed there one night, we thought we'd better move. So there was another hotel listed in the book. Sometimes I'd move two or three hotels in one city just to try all the different places. And in the old book it said it was an oldie worldy hotel and a bit run down. I thought, well, after 25 years, what's it going to be like? 35 years, what's it going to be like now? And it was in a sort of run down part of town, and walk around sort of corner, walk in front of it, and it just looked beautiful. There was no peeling paint. Walked into the foyer and there was people in bow ties and suits and walked up to the counter and see the thing, small luxury hotel of the world chain. It had been totally, because it was a beautiful old building, and they'd built a 15-story building on the back for the accommodation, and they'd made that old building just the reception area and the restaurant upstairs. So it was good and bad with the accommodation.
And that came with the price?
Yes. So that was, most of the places I was staying, we were $4, $5 a night, so it was a bit of a shock to jump up to $350, whatever it was a night. But it was in the old guidebooks. I had to stay there.
Yeah, you must do. I'm going to make it authentic.
And I just swam around in those clean sheets. It was wonderful.
Nice. Yeah. What were some of the highlights of the food you had along the way?
A lot of these restaurants haven't been in the guidebook for 35 years. And what I liked about them is they didn't have hamburgers and cheese toasties on the menu. And they're just catering for locals now, that because they're not in any guidebook. And I felt it was like real authentic food. And, you know, sometimes it's you can go to some nice place, whether it was in Bali or Ubud, Bali or something, you go to a nice place and it's all very, they do Indonesian or Balinese food, but it's very westernised and it's all very nice, clean and thing. But it just felt like you're eating traditional food. Some of that was very traditional in Burma when I ate grasshoppers, fried grasshoppers. But because it said in the guidebook, try them if you dare, and I said, I'll try them. And I'd met this girl, and she said, I asked her, can I try one, so she called someone over because they walk around selling them in big buckets. And I just had one, and I was being very polite and said, oh, that was nice. So then she said something in Burmese and bought me a whole big bucket of them. And then I felt, oh, they don't have much money, and she bought them for me. I better eat them all. And they were sort of burnt and crispy on the outside and sort of gooey like slime snot in the middle. It's the best way to describe it.
Gross.
If you're listening, it's Brian Thacker talking of his culinary adventures in his new book, Tell Them to Get Lost, which is following the trails of Tony Maureen Wheeler's first travel guide for Lonely Planet, which they put out in... They actually developed in 1974, published in 1975.
Yeah.
Now, you spent some time pulling this together, and you've just published, and it's on sale now. How long did it take to actually pull it together, and when did you do your travels for this?
Yeah, it was because I've changed publishers, because I was with Alan Unwin, now I'm with Random House, so there was a bit of sort of playing around getting a new publisher, because I did this trip almost 2 years ago now. But then I wrote it sort of the end of last year, started writing it, and finished it in March, I think.
Mm. So you were saying that you actually take notes along the way. So do you have like a little leather-bound notebook that you're furiously writing all the time? Or
it's an old... I take exercise books like you had when you were in primary school. That's
yeah.
what I take.
Okay.
So you're not a Hemingway. You're a lower-class version of a Hemingway, you know?
Yes.
He has his leather-bound manuals and you have the inserts.
Yeah.
But I suppose they're easy to find. I mean, because you must be writing. You're a creative writer. You're a copious writer. Or are you not? Is it difficult to write while you're travelling?
Oh, no. When it's great stories and great things happen, I think it's easy. And if there's great dialogue and you have great interviews with people, you just can't write enough, you know what I mean? Of the things that you see and do. So, and I jam-pack the trip, so there's always things happening to get a story, you know.
Do you forward send completed books back home so they're safe, or do you carry the whole lot with you?
No, I carry a whole lot with me, and it's like, which is a bit scary, because, I mean, they can take all my clothes. I don't care if I was running around naked, as long as they don't take my exercise books. So I keep them pretty tight to me.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
Me wandering around naked?
No. Well, yeah, I can imagine that. Whether I want to or not is another issue.
I think I prefer the grasshoppers with the slimy bits.
You know, I don't even send postcards, really, when I'm on holidays. You must write postcards, though.
Yeah, and I collect postcards.
Yeah, because I've seen some of those on your website, actually. Yeah. No, I send an occasional postcard, but my handwriting's really bad, so, you know, most of the people get it, and they wait till I get back, and they go, oh, okay, now you can tell me what the trip was about.
I am a postcard sender. I mean, I hit the airport lounges, and I'm just longing for a plane to be delayed so I can fire off another couple of postcards before be called to the gate.
You know, a friend of mine who's an admin whiz suggested actually putting all of your friends' addresses in Outlook or an Excel spreadsheet and actually printing mailing labels. So rather than bringing your address book and potentially losing it, you just rip off the little labels and pop them on the postcard with everybody's address, so you don't need to write it out.
Would that be as much fun, getting a pre-printed label on a postcard?
It sounds very corporate, doesn't it? But, you know, it's a suggestion.
Under my first book, which I hadn't written any books before, at the back of my book it says, Brian has vast writing experience. He's written over 1,000 postcards in his travels. That's what I wrote back of my first book.
Oh. Were there any places that hadn't changed at all, but were just fantastic places? Not the grubby, grimy ones, but somewhere that was just a gem, that was a gem then and it's still a gem.
In a place called, it's Lake Toba, and Samosir Island, which is in Sumatra, and it was a popular place in 1974. There was a lot written about it, and it was a real hippie hangout, and it is just stunning. It's one of the deepest lakes in the world, one of the biggest mountain lakes in the world, and warm, clear water, and you get this boat across to this island, and there's all these accommodation right on the water, and they all have their little pier and a little beach, and you swim in the water, and they're so cheap, and there was just no one there, and there's lots of reasons why this happened. There used to be direct flights to Medan, which is the nearest city from Garuda. Used to fly from Frankfurt and from Amsterdam. But then who was it? Suharto's children had bought land in Bali, so he redirected the flights to Bali. And then there was the Muslim area, and then there was bombings around there. Then there's all these reasons why no one comes to this place anymore. And because of planes, people can fly everywhere so cheaply with AirAsia for $10 that people then go from, they get down the bottom of Malaysia and then they can just fly to Bali or to Java. They don't have to go overland like they used to. So it was a big route that anyone used to follow through. And this place was beautiful. And I had Hotel Carolina, which was in the old guidebook, as the best cheap accommodation in Southeast Asia. Tony Wheeler said it was. And it was still there and it was still cheap. I upgraded to the best room with a big huge room with a balcony overlooking the water, and I paid $11 a night. And we go to the restaurants, and the guy was still running the restaurant, who was in 1974, and he was like surprised to see us. He hadn't any guests for a week, and they had to sort of run out down the road to get ingredients to make dinner. But it was a beautiful place. I mean, I think they get some tourists, they get them from Indonesia, some local tourists, and maybe the European somewhere, and there's more coming over a little bit, but it was empty, and it was a stunning place.
So it's paved with yellow bricks. Well, is it paved with yellow bricks? We've got a bit of your music.
Yes.
Haven't we? What's the track you're about to play for us now?
We're going with another hit from 1974. Coming up, it's Elton John. Sorry, it's my DJ voice. It's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road.
You're on Detours with Jodie and Greg, and this is Brian Thacker playing some of his music as he explores Tell Them to Get Lost, his new book.
My own mind. You know you can't hold me forever. I didn't sign up for you. I'm not a present for your friends to open. This boy's too young to be singing.
Hello there, this is Funny Lady Judith Lucy, and you're listening to Joy 94.9. Well, you'd be crazy to listen to anything else.
Of course you would be crazy to listen to anything else, and we're glad that you're with us up to 1 o'clock today here on Joy. I'm Jodie, joined by Greg. This is Detours, and that gorgeous track, a really, really classic track by Elton John, Yellow Brick Road, here on Joy. Now, coming up at 1 o'clock, we'll have Cravings with Pete Dillon, and this week it's all about the Age Good Food Guide. But also from the 5th to the 10th of September, we've got Victoria Tourism Week, and there's a range of events happening throughout Victoria in metropolitan, regional and rural areas. And if you want to jump online, victoriatourismweek.com.au. I'll be speaking at the conference, which was one of the hallmark events next week, and I'm speaking about inclusive and accessible tourism, so stay tuned.
Fantastic, Jodie.
And joining us here in the studio is Brian Thacker. We're talking about his latest book, Tell Them to Get Lost. How did you come up with the title for this?
Yes, in the old guidebook, Tony Wheeler suggests when you get to the Lao border, if it's a weekend, and he says if they try to charge you more for a visa on the weekend, tell them to get lost.
Uh-huh.
And I arrived on the weekend and they still charge more. But the guy had a very large gun in his lap, so I wasn't telling him to get lost.
Yeah, I tend not to argue with people with guns generally in my travels.
Did you see much of that? Did you see get a sense of change from 1974 when Tony and Maureen did their research to now? I mean, was it just that one occurrence with an airport guard with guns?
Well, also the thing, back in 74, it didn't have to all be PC, so Tony would suggest a good place to get magic mushroom pizzas and where to buy dope and things, you know what I mean? So I don't think you could say that in a new guidebook anymore. But
did you stumble across any of that?
Accidentally I did. On Samosir Island, which is probably why I keep thinking it's so magical, is Tony suggests in the old guidebook a lot through Indonesia. He says, have the Nasi Goreng, you know. So after my Nasi Goreng number 27, we stopped somewhere and I thought I'd have a pizza. They had pizzas. Oh, that'd be nice. I had a mushroom pizza. And it didn't taste it horrible. It only had two or three slices. But I was on the other side of the island. When I got on my bike to head back, I started feeling a bit dizzy and strange. And I went, it took me a while to figure it out. That the mushroom part was under quotation marks. There was magic mushroom pizza.
Oh, okay.
So I was a bit sort of spaced out on the way back. But
what happened? Was there any sort of ramifications from that?
Well, on the way to where we'd got to on the other side of the island, I'd had three crashes on my bike, on my scooter. One I'd hit a truck. It doesn't sound as bad as it was. I just sort of rolled into a truck and fell off. I hit two fighting goats in the middle of the road, and I fell off a bridge. But on the way back, I was cruising as fast as I could. Not a single accident, so the magic mushrooms probably helped.
Now, you were mentioning before about flights and changes of air routes. Were there any trips that you did, you know, that took longer, shorter, or what about the cost of those journeys?
Oh, yeah. Some of them were particularly airfares. Back then, they were regulated by the government, so it doesn't matter what airline you flew with, that was the price you paid. And I actually did quite a bit of research into how much people's average age was then, wage was, and also comparing that to how much flights were. And it is just, we pay up to sometimes a 50th of the price of what they did back then.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yes, they are so cheap. And in AirAsia have flights for, you know, $10. And back then, the equivalent for that flight was maybe $500, the equivalent of today's money, you know, and how much you earn and everything else. So it's just, there was a massive difference in that. But even on the smaller scale with buses, local transport, in Bacau, in East Timor, I caught a bus from Dili to Bacau. And in the old guidebook, it was $3 and it took 6 hours. And it had gone down in price, it was now $2. And then the bus would stop and drop people off. And then at one point it stopped and everybody got off and I was staying on the bus. And the driver's motioning for me to get off the bus. And I wasn't getting anywhere else. I had another more than 3 hours to go on the bus. And then he said, Bacau. And I said, yes, I'm going to Bacau. Yes, Bacau. And he goes, Bacau, Bacau. And I'm going, Bacau. He said this about 20 times until I realised I was actually in Bacau. So not only was the bus cheaper, it now took half the time because they'd built better roads.
What about when you both reflect on in your life, did you ever go off and send off a relative who were going on a boat trip somewhere? I remember as a child going to the docks and saying goodbye to my grandparents who were going to England for you know, 6 weeks on a boat, and it was a huge event. I mean, you know, we all got dressed up in, you know, polished patent leather shoes and little white socks with, you know, frilly lace and our best outfits because it was so exciting because they were going away on this epic adventure.
Yeah, well, I grew up with the great aunt. The great aunt was like, it was a cousin of my grandmother's who, it turned out after she demised, we worked out she was an illegitimate child fathered by a Maori and had come across, and that was why she always had the darker tan in the family. And she used to be one of those ones, you know, spinster woman who'd go off and do these amazing world adventures and come back with trunks and trunks of things from all exotic places around the world and sit down and you'd go through these items. And then the grandmother used to go as well on the trips with her housemate, my godmother, the unrelative aunt that used to live with her. And it was a big thing, wasn't it? It was a generational thing, I think, for people that probably would be in their hundreds now if they were still alive today.
Yeah, I remember my nana used to, on the other side of the family, you know, would always have ready wash and wear outfits because you could always wash them in the shower and then hang them on, you know, this polyester type material and they dry really quickly.
I'm seeing you in polyester now, Jodie. I'm actually thinking you know, white polyester with floral prints. I can see it happening.
That's right.
Well, Brian and I might like to dress up in polyester. What do you reckon?
I had a bit of itchy polyester on the other day at the launch.
You did, yeah. It was a fantastic outfit.
But the other amazing thing about 74, or even in the 80s, was that there was no email or no contact. If you wanted to get mail, you had to get it sent to Post Restante. Even when I travelled in the 80s, you had to do that. So I'd go for months without speaking to my family, because besides sending the odd letter or something. And today, of course, it's so different because everywhere you go is just full of internet cafes. Whether you're in the middle of Sumatra or the middle of Mongolia, travellers in internet cafes on Facebook, on status saying, here I am in an internet cafe in Mongolia. You know, that's people are already loading all their photos. You already know what their trip's like when they're halfway through it.
Yeah, that is incredible, isn't it?
Was there a challenge doing that? I mean, because if people are doing that in the immediacy of travel and photos on the net, is the value of a travel book declining? And how do you then capture that interest and keep people interested? Because you can't produce books unless you have readers. So is there a challenge for you as an author, Brian?
Yeah, well, it's just to come out with a good story. I couldn't just travel through Southeast Asia and write, I wrote this book about traveling through Southeast Asia, because I can find anything on the internet. But you can't find a comparison travel like that and then to actually have the experiences of meeting the people. So it's a matter of finding a hook that makes the book different. You know, you can't just go off travelling anymore and write a book unless you're Bill Bryson or someone.
Yeah, but I think, you know, there's a lot of people whose travel books I've read, and I don't think they necessarily thought they had an interesting story to tell, but you're right, it's about that hook and, you know, something that happens along the way or some sort of realisation or just, you know, a time and a place that's right and somebody who's really gifted as a writer as you are as well. Tell Them to Get Lost is available now in the bookstores and... have you got any? I mean, I know that you've just wrapped this project up, and you know it's now out and about. Have you got any other plans underway at the moment for any new books?
I've got two ideas, which I'm not quite sure of which one to do. I used to be a tour leader in Europe, taking bus tours around Europe with drunk Aussies and Kiwis.
Yep.
And next year will be 20 years since I did those trips, and I thought it'd be fun to go back with people who went on tours, you know, 20, 30 years ago and take them on exactly the same tour and it's about their life and go to the same places and because the same places that were there, the same, whether it's a sex show in Amsterdam or the camp or a nightclub in Florence, they're still the same places they took them 30 years ago. So it'd be interesting sort of, it'd be great if we could find people who'd met on one of these tours and got married or, you know, I could try to find it. That was one idea I had.
Now, one thing I did notice in your book, you did find one place in your adventures this time that has a connection to contemporary gay world.
Oh, yes. About that. The Malaysia Hotel. It was the place to stay, in one of the places to stay in all Southeast Asia, the Malaysia Hotel in Bangkok, back in 1974. And it was cheap, but it had a swimming pool and it had a nice restaurant and... It was all run down. They said sinks used to fall off the wall and everything. So I didn't know it was there, of course, and got a taxi from the airport and took us to the Malaysia Hotel and brought into reception and with Beth. And after a few minutes, we sort of noticed, I said, oh, there's no girls here. I haven't seen any girls here. We got on the lift and a gentleman and he's got on, who had tight little white shorts on and a big bushy mustache holding a man's hand. And I went, it's a gay hotel, but
yeah.
And then we went down to dinner, and you know, everyone's all lounging by the pool, and Beth was sort of the only woman there. You know,
she's sort of a fag hag. Yeah.
So did you get anyone approach you? You know, a bit of a wink and a grin.
No, now and again, but the waiter came up and said, "Hello, sweetie," and I thought he was talking to Beth, but he was speaking to me. But
how cool!
And then, but also, I was going to say there was something that was very funny about the place. It was still the same hotel though it was from 35 years ago.
The Majestic.
Yeah. No, it was the Malaysia Hotel.
The Malaysia Hotel. Yeah. Oh, cool.
So, Greg, do you think that attitudes have changed towards gay and lesbian travellers over a period of time, or Brian? I mean, you travel heaps. Do you think people generally feel safe and okay if they respect local cultures?
Oh, definitely, I think. And it was the whole guidebook thing and everything else, you know, that they have sections and for... You know, places to hang out. If you want to hang out, you know, with other gay people, they tell you the good clubs to go to.
I think you're right. I mean, it doesn't seem to be, you know, a lack of information or you know, people are always really ready and willing to share their suggestions or ideas. And I think that's the thing, you know, I'm definitely with you in terms of just turning up and experiencing it. But I think for some gay and lesbian travellers, that little bit of extra research can help them work out the places that are definitely the go-to places as opposed to maybe places that aren't so safe.
It's fantastic. Oh, look, I've really enjoyed this visit, Brian. You're right, I think it's your fifth visit to Detours, and they just keep getting more interesting. We look forward to your next journeys as you travel the world writing great books.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, our pleasure. Safe journeys, and thanks for joining us here on Detours, and thanks to Maria from Newport, who'd like to say thanks for reminding of her trip in the 70s. We'll be back again next Saturday at 12 noon here on Joy 94.9.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
Your voice, your radio station. Joy 94.9.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with joy.